Often when people go into health policy or they talk about health policy, they're talking about health care policy. How can we pay for treating people once they're already sick? But what interests me most is how we can use science and policy to help to prevent people from getting sick in the first place.
If the healthy option at the restaurant costs 5 times as much as the junk food option, it's going to be hard to make that choice when you're constrained economically. Policy over politics, right? Welcome back to the Marian Flaxman Network Podcast, a podcast dedicated to reintroducing personal narratives into critical public health topics. On today's episode, my conversation with Melissa Mayton Shepherd. Melissa is a public health policy consultant who runs her own firm, MMS Health Strategies. On today's episode, we talk about her journey from being a child who thought she wanted nothing to do with health law to an adult who works with it almost every single day. Melissa describes her journey from education throughout her career, working with many different organizations across the aisle to advance bipartisan public health policy that makes society healthier. Please enjoy my conversation with Melissa Mayton Shepherd. I'm so excited to have you here. So I want to jump right in with one of my favorite questions, because when I was a kid, a lot of my friends' parents had jobs like doctor, lawyer, teacher, things that you might see in a Richard Scarry book. And my dad had a job like consultant, something that I could not explain to my friends, something that nobody was picturing that what they wanted to be when they grew up, like thinking, I want to be a consultant. So when I talk to someone like yourself who has such a title that a five-year-old would not know to pick, I'm always very curious to understand, what did you think you wanted to be when you grew up? And how did that dream morph into what you do today?
So when I was a kid, my mother was an attorney and my father is a health economist in academia. And I thought that both of their jobs were very boring. And so I decided that I did not want either of those jobs or anything like it when I grew up. I wanted to be a teacher. And when I was a kid, I would lay out all my dolls and stuffed animals and pretend to teach to them. And ironically, my job now as a public health policy consultant incorporates aspects of the law and aspects of public health and academia. And I'm also an adjunct faculty member at George Washington University. So I also teach. So despite me wanting nothing to do with either of my parents' careers, and I don't have identical career to either of them, I do incorporate aspects of what I saw them doing and what I thought I wanted to be when I grew up.
That's awesome. And I love picturing that, like little Melissa setting up her stuffed animals. And I think, like you said, it's very funny that you saw what your parents were doing. You thought, that's not for me. And yet looking at it now, there are bits of that woven into all of the work that you do. So how did you get from that place of, okay, I don't want to do health economics, to what you're doing now? If you thought you wanted to be a teacher, what did you go off and study in college, and how did that pivot towards the work you're currently doing?
So I went to George Washington University for both my undergrad and my master's, and that's where I teach now as an adjunct faculty member. And when I was in college, I was exploring a range of interests and ended up being a psychology major and a women's studies and sociology minor. And throughout college, I had a number of internships that took me down that path of clinical psychology and direct intervention with one person at a time. And I explored sociology internships, and I got frustrated with the idea of only being able to help one person at a time. And that's only if that one person really takes up your advice. And so it was frustrating. So sometimes I felt like I was putting a lot of effort into trying to help one person at a time. And then it was during my senior year of college that I had an internship at a public health advocacy organization, an organization that actually went on to be one of my clients 15 plus years later, and that exposed me to the world of public health policy. And I had an opportunity to work on a report that they were developing around obesity policy, and that opened my eyes to this is another career path and a job that I could have. And it opened my eyes to public health policy and the idea that while policy change takes a very long time, you're not just helping one person at a time. You could help hundreds or thousands or even millions of people through just one policy change. And so I decided that that was the career path for me. And I, after that internship, I got a full-time job in public health policy. And then I decided to go on and get my master's degree in public policy, concentrating in public health. And I was still working in the field while going to school part-time and completing my degree. And I've been working in public health policy ever since.
I really love that you shared all those aspects because we have something similar in our backgrounds, which is I've always been passionate about health and wellness. And the first thing I did was I got certified as a health coach. And I had that same experience of I really love helping people, but helping one person at a time sometimes feels not enough. Like you really want to know how can I exponentially grow this benefit? And then I took that into restaurants so I could feed lots of people, right? Healthy food. I always was serving healthy food. And that was exciting. And I still saw there are barriers here. Not everyone can afford to dine out. Not everyone knows about this restaurant. And so again, I was searching for how could I help more people? And then somebody said to me, I think that you would really love public health. And so it was that same kind of frustration with the impact of just that one-to-one experience, which of course is incredibly valuable. We need practitioners doing one-to-one work. I still do work one-on-one with people, but the public health framework facilitates all of that. And without public health policies, fewer people are able to access one-on-one support. So it's all connected, but I just wanted to sort of reflect that back because I didn't realize that we both had that same thing that kind of drove us towards public health, this desire to help more than one person at a time.
And I think one of the things that's so important about public health policy is it's about using evidence and research to inform policy and systems changes. So it's about making it easier to make healthy choices. And often when people go into health policy or they talk about health policy, they're talking about health care policy. And they're talking about how can we pay for treating people once they're already sick. And that's very important. But what interests me most is how we can use science and policy to help to prevent people from getting sick in the first place. And when you think about the leading causes of death in the U.S. and in many places in the world, they're non-communicable diseases. They're chronic diseases. They're cancer. They're heart disease, stroke, diabetes, and complications. And these are all diseases that have lifestyle factors, common lifestyle factors, poor diet, physical inactivity, tobacco use, excess alcohol use, excess weight. And so my career has been dedicated to using policy, using what we know about what leads to these factors and conditions to help people change their lifestyle, not individuals, but on a macro scale, help to change policies and systems to make it easier for people to lead healthy lives and help to prevent and manage these leading chronic conditions.
Yeah. And that's such a critical point, is the making it easier for people to lead healthy lives. Because sometimes the framework of personal choice versus public health, they're viewed as opposites or as conflicting with each other. But in fact, a public health framework that supports healthy personal choices is essential. If the healthy option at the restaurant costs five times as much as the junk food option, it's going to be hard to make that choice when you're constrained economically in any capacity. So building public health policies that effectively promote healthier choices helps to make that choice easier for the individual when personal choice is on the table. We can't expect people to make irrational choices, but how often in today's world is the unhealthy choice the more rational one because it's faster, cheaper, easier, tastier, whatever it might be? We need to create a system that facilitates the healthier choice being the rational choice.
That's exactly right. And people can only make that healthier choice if it's even on the menu or if they know what is a healthier choice versus a less healthier choice. And so they need to have information about what constitutes a healthy diet or what they need to improve their own health. And there need to be the conditions in order to support people in making healthy choices. It's hard to build physical activity into our healthy lives. It's easy to grab something that's packaged and might not be nutritious because we're on the go and we don't have time to cook a healthy meal and we don't have time to sit down and we don't have time to read the back of a food label when grocery shopping. And we've been conditioned to like foods that are high in added sugars and saturated fat and sodium, and those might not be the best things for our bodies. We might know that, but that's just what's available. That's what we enjoy. That's what's convenient and affordable. And so it really takes changing policies and systems at a macro level. It's not just one thing. It's a combination of changes to policies and systems that make it easier for people to make healthy choices on top of personal responsibility. There is an aspect of personal responsibility, of course, but people make choices based on the choices that are available and the environments that they live in and what they've learned about and what they've been doing their entire life.
Yeah. And at that intersection, so much important work happens. So taking your obvious passion for the topic, experience in the topic, you know, yada, 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 years pass, you decide to strike out on your own and become a consultant, that thing that does not exist in the Richard Scarry universe. Or maybe it does, and I just haven't turned to that page. But I don't think there are consultants in that book. So how did you make that choice to shift away from working for other people to working for yourself and taking your passion, making it your career, and taking that forward?
So I turned to consulting by accident. I had worked for national nonprofit organizations focused on public health policy change at all levels of government, addressing risk factors, leading risk factors for chronic conditions. And I knew the type of work that I wanted to do. And when I was looking for a new job, I didn't want to just take whatever job was available. I wanted to find the job and the career that would be the next long-term opportunity for me. And so I started networking, and I probably met with about 100 people over the course of about a year. And that seems like a lot, but when you think about there's about 50 working weeks in a year, that's really only 2 meetings a week. So it really wasn't that big of a lift. But having that many networking meetings in a relatively short amount of time gave me so much opportunity. And I learned about organizations that I didn't even know existed. And I really broadened my network of professionals in the field. And through that network, I identified a number of consulting opportunities that I was able to take on. And initially, I thought these would be the short-term projects that would allow me to continue to look for the perfect full-time job for me. But what I found was that I really enjoyed these consulting projects, and I didn't want to end them after a few months when I would potentially find a full-time job. I wanted to continue this consulting work. And so I shifted my efforts from looking for full-time jobs to looking for other consulting projects to supplement and build upon the exciting work that I was already doing. And that's when I established MMS Health Strategies, which is my consulting firm, to allow me to continue to do this consulting work as a career. And it's now been 8 years, and I'm really enjoying my work as a consultant.
That's awesome. Tell me a bit more about that. What are some of the projects or types of projects that you've done over the last 5-10 years? Which ones have been your favorite? Which ones really light you up? Which ones have felt the most aligned with the things that you're passionate about?
So I put the work that I do into 3 buckets. So the first one is around public health and policy strategic planning and implementation. So, and the way that the work looks differs depending on the client and their need. And most of my clients are nonprofit organizations and academia with some type of public health or food systems or social good mission. And so my work has involved strategic planning for the organization as a whole, helping them figure out what their strategy or next step should be. It's involved public policy strategic planning, figuring out what their policy agenda should be. Sometimes it's focused on one specific topic, so they want to do more in one particular area and need to identify what the landscape and the opportunities look like. Sometimes they've already developed their strategy and they need someone to work with them to implement it. And so that involves executing on public policy and advocacy tactics to see their agenda come to fruition. And then the second area where I do a lot of work, I call it special projects, but it always has some type of public policy, chronic disease connection. So sometimes that's about planning a convening of stakeholders to identify areas of challenge and areas of consensus on a topic. Sometimes it's about consensus building and developing a set of policy recommendations. Sometimes it's putting together a report that translates research into policy for policymaker, advocate, or consumer or scientific audiences. Sometimes it's a case study report looking at best practices around a policy area. Sometimes it's a comment letter, but it always usually involves some type of discrete project towards one specific goal within a relatively short time period. And then the third area where I work is policy and science writing. And I tell my students where I teach at GW that writing is a skill that they will use throughout their life. And that's one of my core areas is focused on writing. So I do a lot of meeting proceedings. I write and edit consensus studies. I write blog posts. So anything that involves writing around a food or nutrition or public health topic. And often I have the opportunity to attend a really interesting scientific meeting or presentation and use that to translate and disseminate the information in written form to key audiences. So those are the three main areas where I work. And just to highlight a few projects of interest. So one where you and I had an opportunity to work together a few years ago, an academic client hired my firm because the White House Conference on Hunger, Nutrition, and Health was coming up. And this was only the second time in more than 50 years that there had been a White House conference on these issues. And the administration was seeking input from a wide range of stakeholders on what should be included in their national strategy on hunger, nutrition, and health. And my client wanted to put together the most comprehensive, most diverse, most multi-stakeholder set of recommendations to inform that conference and that report. And so the client convened a task force of 20 very diverse leaders in the field. There were about 20 organizations that comprised a strategy group. There were 3 in-person convenings held at different places around the country. There were 75 written reports with evidence-based policy recommendations, and there was a host of listening sessions of individuals with lived experience that were held around the country. And my firm was hired to compile all of this information and use this to inform a comprehensive set of evidence-based policy recommendations that all 20 task force members could agree to within a relatively short period of time. And so I had the opportunity to work with other established consultants and with staff from my client organization. And in just a couple of months, we put together a very comprehensive report and had the opportunity to present the report to staff within the White House and federal agencies. And ultimately, when the report came out from the White House, their national strategy, there was a lot of recommendations that were included from our report. And so I was really thrilled to have had the opportunity to inform such an important and impactful policy report from the federal government.
That was very fun as well. Maybe I'm crazy for thinking so, but that was a wild summer. It was just laptops and late nights and like poring over policy documents and trying to get very diverse stakeholders to agree on a list of recommendations when sometimes it felt like it wasn't possible to come to a consensus. But what a wild ride.
Yeah, it was exciting. And just to highlight a couple other projects that I've been working on more recently as well. So I also do some work in the physical activity space. And there's a lot of evidence around physical activity and exercise improving outcomes for people with cancer. And so I'm working with a nonprofit and academic organization on an initiative called Moving Through Cancer that's focused on making exercise and physical activity part of the standard of care for people with cancer. And as a policy advisor, I'm working with them to help to map out a policy strategy for incorporating evidence-based recommendations related to physical activity and exercise into healthcare delivery and healthcare financing. So that's been exciting and challenging, and there's a lot of parallels in what the opportunities are in the physical activity space with what there are in the food space.
That's really exciting. And I just want to highlight through all of this that the work that you're doing is so often as a translator, because we hear the call from the public, from stakeholders to look to the evidence. You know, what does the evidence say, and how should we move forward in terms of diet, in terms of physical activity, in terms of lifestyle? So first of all, we have to create the evidence base. That's part of the work. But then the evidence base isn't really designed to be implemented into policy, right? You can't design a study with the thought, how will this become public policy? You have to focus on making it the best possible study that it can be, given all the relative limitations that have to exist for that topic, right? But then there has to be someone who's able to take that evidence base and carry it over to policymakers and say, you know, look at this systematic review, look at this consensus report, look at these 10 studies, you know, they all sort of support this. Based on all of that, I recommend we craft a policy like this. And then, of course, there's the art and the science of policy making. But I really am hearing in so much of the work that you do that you're playing this role of translator, that you're building the bridge between science and policy, because having that evidence base is so important. But how does the evidence base get into policy? Policymakers have a lot on their plate. They often have 5 minutes to review a document before they go into a critical meeting. How can that document speak to the needs of the population quickly and clearly enough that they can utilize that information and take it into their work? And I just see how critical that work is, that bridge building, because if we want evidence-based policy, we need people who help to carry the evidence base into the policy. And that's so much of the work that you're doing.
Well, and that's what advocacy is all about. And academics that are doing the research and scientists publish in peer-reviewed journals, but policymakers aren't reading peer-reviewed journals. And so what advocates and policy analysts need to do is take that information, take that science from the peer-reviewed journals and the scientific conferences, and put it into one-pagers, put it into infographics, put it into talking points, put it into calls to action that advocates and lobbyists and constituents can take to members of Congress, can take to the federal agencies and the state agencies that are making the policy, and translate that into language and format that they can understand. And that's what a lot of my work is translating evidence to policy to allow policymakers that are making those decisions, as you said, very quickly, to be able to have the information that they need to be able to make the best possible decisions that they can. And also, it's important for them to know how their decisions would impact their constituents. And so those constituent stories and hearing from people in their districts are very important as well. And so getting that information to not just people in DC, but people on the ground is also very important.
Absolutely. There's a really great example of this, I think, from sort of the current day policymaking sphere around healthy eating, which is this topic of ultra processed foods, right? It's a buzzword right now, ultra processed foods. I'm pretty sure it's been in a few New York Times headlines in the last few weeks, few months. And there's a research classification scale, the NOVA classification scale, for defining what is an ultra-processed food and where does it fall on that scale. And so you're now hearing people saying, we need policy to control ultra-processed foods, and then they point to the NOVA scale. But the NOVA scale was designed for research, not for policy. And even the people who founded, created the NOVA scale are saying, this is not, it wasn't made for regulation. It wasn't a regulatory scale. It was just strictly for us to break these foods down into groups for research purposes. We need a new scale for regulatory purposes. And so now there is the birth of a new conversation around, okay, we have NOVA, we have that framework for research, for talking about it. What will the new framework be for policy? How will we decide how to grade different foods? What's the logistical framework that makes sense in terms of putting limits on foods or taxation or whatever the policy making might be? I think it's so interesting to see how the needs of the research don't always match the needs of the policymaking. And even when there's a direct line from the evidence to a public health need, right? There's a lot of ultra-processed foods in our system. People have chronic diet-related disease. We need regulatory frameworks around ultra-processed foods. Okay, maybe we can all agree on that. But then what is that framework? How do we translate and change and reinterpret all of the evidence into something that a regulator, that a policymaker could actually apply to their day-to-day work? That is so meaningful and so critical.
I think the challenge is that we don't have a common definition of ultra-processed foods, and we also don't know what aspects of ultra-processed foods are the ones that are leading to diet-related chronic conditions. So is it that ultra-processed foods are often high in added sugars, saturated fat, sodium? Is it because they are often high in certain additives? They often have food dyes in them. Is it because of the way they're made, the processing techniques that are used? So the evidence is emerging, and there are studies that point to one rationale or one reasoning over another. But the evidence is still accumulating, and I think it's important that any framework for ultra-processed foods really take into consideration what we know and what we don't know about what aspects of food and diet cause chronic conditions. And we shouldn't wait for all of the science to make policy, but the policy does need to be informed by the best available data that we have right now.
Yeah, and something kind of fringe that came up during one of the convenings ahead of the White House conference was the role of food packaging, even. And I had never thought about that. And someone in one of the meetings said, you know, maybe one of the contributing factors of the negative health impact of ultra-processed foods is the plastic that it's wrapped in, or something that's coating the plastic, or something that's coating the paper that it's wrapped in. So, you know, I don't think anyone's done a double-blind, placebo-controlled clinical trial of, you know, a ultra-processed, sugary, high-fat food wrapped in plastic versus sitting out in the air, right? And it would probably take a long time and a lot of money to run that trial, but it's yet another factor to consider and yet another thing that adds to the complexity of this regulatory space, which is, what if it's the packaging? What if it's something we aren't even thinking about? What if it's a proxy? What if the ultra-processed foods are a proxy for something else, right? So anyway, I mean, I'm pretty sure we could talk about this topic all day long, but it just is such a great example of the nuance and the need for experienced translators in this space who are both passionate, educated, and know how to look at the evidence, but then carry it into the policymaking space.
Yeah, and I think that the role of plastics or food packaging or contaminants in our food certainly should be explored. But as I had said previously, I think we need to make policy based on what we know. So, for example, a candy bar that's wrapped in a different type of packaging is still a candy bar.
Candy bar wrapped in organic cotton.
And even an organic candy bar, it's still going to be most likely high in added sugars, high in saturated fat, calorie dense and not the type of food that we should be eating in large amounts. I'm not saying eat never. Certainly, there's room for foods in moderation, but that's not the type of food that we should be encouraging as a regular part of our diet. And we know that now. And right. So I think we can make policy based on what the evidence has shown is at a population level as part of a regular diet is a contributor to leading diet-related kind of conditions. We can act on what we know now while continuing the research to further explore what some additional contributing factors might be and what policy and other levers might be effective.
Yeah, I'm just picturing someone like listening to this podcast and then going on social media and like clicking through and seeing an ad for like an all organic candy bar wrapped in organic cotton wrapping, like no PFAS, no plastic. And maybe after hearing this conversation, they'll think, that's still not a health food, I don't think.
It's still a candy bar.
That is still a candy bar. And I'm not going to have that for lunch. I'm still going to have my salad. Okay. Well, speaking of food, I think it's very exciting that you created, not just our teaching, but created a class at the GW Global Food Institute. So I would love to hear a bit about that. How did you come to create this class? How are you bringing all of your experience to it? And what's been the most fun about it?
So I've been an adjunct faculty member at GW for 4 years now, and I was originally teaching in the public health school. And about 2 years ago, Jose Andres launched the GW Global Food Institute with the mission of changing the world through the power of food. And as part of the Global Food Institute, GW also launched a brand new food leadership minor. And they had a request for proposals for new courses to fulfill that food leadership minor. And there were three pillars, one of which was policy. And so this seems like the perfect fit for me to design a new course that would fit within this new stream of courses that they were looking to develop. So inspired by my prior teaching experience at GW, I proposed a course that was focused around stakeholder engagement in public policy and or in food policy specifically. So how is food policy really made? Who's involved? What strategies do they take? Who do they work with? How do they move it forward? And the idea was to leverage GW's location in Washington, D.C., in the nation's capital, close to the epicenter of federal policymaking, to give students hands-on experience and getting to see in real time how federal policymaking on food happens. And fortunately, my course proposal was accepted, and I'm now in my second semester teaching this class.
And so for your students, they are curious about food policy. Maybe they're curious about public health, about food leadership. What do you think they like most about the class? I know they go on some field trips to Capitol Hill. I'm sure you're teaching them about your experiences. What have you heard from them in terms of what they're loving most about the topic?
Yeah. So one of the things that I've heard from my students, and going back to your original comment about there are many career paths out there that someone might not think about as a child. So many of my students hadn't ever considered food policy as a career path, but some of them are exploring this now. And I think that shift in mindset or shift in career goals was driven in part by the experiences that they had in my class. And as you mentioned, I take my students to Capitol Hill. They meet with congressional staff from both sides of the aisle to hear bipartisan perspectives on pressing food policy issues. Prior to the government shutdown, my students had an opportunity to visit the U.S. Department of Agriculture and meet with staff there and understand a bit about what USDA does related to food policy. My students heard from staff who work in several different agencies within the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, at FDA, at CDC, within the Office of the Secretary, to understand the ways that HHS touches food policy. My students also have had the opportunity to hear from leading advocates at nonprofit organizations, from people within the food industry, We'll have a member of the press come to my class later in the semester. They've learned about legal advocacy. And my students will also have an opportunity to participate in a mini internship where they will become really a staff person at an organization that's either making food policy or working to inform food policy and get a sense of what it might be like to work there and then share their experiences with the class.
That is so awesome. I'm jealous. And I have taken some fun classes, including a food policy class, but your class sounds very fun.
I wish I could have taken it when I was a student.
Right? And that's the best part about being a grown-up is being able to create things for young people that you wish you had when you were young. So That is such a thrill. You mentioned that as of right now, as of the recording, the government is currently shut down. And working in policy, of course, that could be a little stressful. D.C. is quiet right now downtown. It's not its usual bustling self. But of course, you've worked in policy for a long time now. You're a veteran and you've seen shutdowns come and go. You've seen many administrations. You've worked across the aisle. And with all the change coming to DC right now, there is stress. There is also opportunity. There are things being talked about that maybe weren't getting the attention that they deserved before. Things that you and I are excited about. Healthy food policy, healthy school meals, exercise, physical activity, all these great things. So in the midst of the stress and the upheaval, what are you excited about? Where do you see the opportunities? And looking ahead, what are you most excited about when you're thinking about the work that you're going to do in the next 1, 2, 5, 10 years?
So I'm excited that we've now seen across two different administrations spanning two political parties an interest in addressing diet-related chronic disease. And that's a topic that I've been working on throughout my entire career. And with the last administration, we had the White House Conference and National Strategy on Hunger, Nutrition, and Health. And with the current administration, we have the Make America Healthy Again movement. And they have different names and they have different approaches and different tactics. But ultimately, I see the end goal as very similar as making it easier for people to make healthy choices that reduce their long-term risk and reduce overall chronic disease in this country. And so I think it's exciting that I see diet and nutrition and chronic disease and lifestyle risk factors as bipartisan issues. So I think it's exciting that that both parties are talking about and taking leadership roles in making policy changes to help people be healthier in this country. I think it's been a long time coming, and I'm really positive. It's really positive to see that much momentum in this space. But what concerns me a bit, at least in the last several months, is all of the budget cuts, the cuts to programs, the cuts to personnel that often are focused on some of these same priority issues that are said to be priorities that are included in the Make America Healthy Again strategy, for example. And so it's hard to accomplish a goal of reducing diet-related chronic conditions or reducing chronic disease or making people healthier more broadly when you're cutting the programs and when you're cutting the staff that are doing just that. And to the government shutdown, we need to open the government to get people back to work, to do the jobs that they've been hired to do in order to continue the important work focused on public health and improving health outcomes.
Yeah. I think, you know, you mentioned with your students for your class, taking them to USDA and FDA and CDC. And I think that I share your excitement about this growing conversation that acknowledges that health spans much more than health care, that health is prevention, that health is physical activity, it's agriculture, it's WIC, it's SNAP. It's so many different things touch the average American's ability to be healthy, to strive towards health. And so I share your excitement about this multi-agency approach to talking about health and food as medicine and the future of all of this, because I think that when we silo health and try to kind of squish it into a box in one corner, we really miss out on the big picture. So I think that, you know, hearing from the leading advocates in the MAHA movement right now, you know, you're hearing people say, don't forget about agriculture. We can't talk about healthy food without talking about agriculture. Well, when you hear it, it's kind of obvious, right? Because we grow food, but it wasn't necessarily said that way before. So I think it's really exciting and it's really hopeful to hear this more holistic conversation about how food, how lifestyle, how all of these factors across many agencies impact our health. But yes, of course, we do hope that we can reopen the government and get back to policymaking, because policy over politics, right? Like, policy is the boots on the ground work, and politics can sometimes be a distraction from that, I think.
That's right. And a lot of my work has been focused on consensus building and bringing people from different perspectives together to see where there are common ground. And that's how sensible policy gets made, is sometimes each entity or each stakeholder group has to compromise a little bit, but ultimately there's a lot more than we can agree on than we disagree on. And so common sense policies is around bringing people together. Evidence-based policy is around where does the science come in to inform what makes sense, what works, not just for science, but also for the people on the ground, and bringing in perspectives within healthcare, within agriculture, within transportation systems, within climate, within energy, within so many different systems and sectors to find where is their common ground, how can we work together towards shared goals and agendas.
Yeah, I totally agree. So I want to ask you a way zoomed out, big picture kind of a question, looking ahead, I don't know, 100 years, 50 years, 25 years. I was very fortunate. I had a professor who I believe you're friends with, Margot Wootan. She taught my food policy class. And she's sort of famous in the world of food policy as being the gal who got the trans fat ban pushed across the finish line, right? And she worked on that, I don't know, for 15, 20 years. I mean, that was her baby. That was her passion project. And I think that anyone who is hip to the scene of food policy, if there is such a thing as like food policy hipsters, they know her name. They know that she's on that bill. So in the future, in this faraway land, when people are looking back at your career and they're like, oh, Melissa, oh, she's the gal who, boom, did this. Is there something that you are so passionate about that you hope to make a lasting and memorable impact on that field or that particular topic? And if so, I'm curious what it is.
Well, I think one of the exciting opportunities as a consultant is getting to work on so many different projects. Some of them are short term, some of them are longer term. In the 8 years or so that I've been a consultant, I've worked with maybe two dozen clients or two dozen different projects. And so policy change takes many years, sometimes many decades to come to fruition. And so often there isn't just one thing or one person that moves it towards the finish line, even around reducing trans fat in the food supply. Margot played a key role, but there are many other stakeholders that were involved as well. And so my goal is to play a small role in policy change, whatever that might be, that makes a difference towards public health and social good outcomes. So whether that's contributing a seminal report or contributing to research or disseminating and translating science or bringing stakeholders together to have those necessary conversations to identify common ground or bringing the message to legislators or to regulators about certain public health issues. That's the work that I want to do, that I am doing. And hopefully in some incremental way, it's continuing to have an impact on public health and policy outcomes.
Absolutely. Well, Melissa, I feel like we've covered so much today, and I have really enjoyed hearing you share about the work that you do, about why you do the work that you do, and how diverse and meaningful it is. Because I think that one of the cool things about being a consultant is that you can chase these projects that are exciting, and impactful, and you can play, as you just said, a pivotal role, a small but pivotal role, small but mighty role, in so many different things that trickle, 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 and ultimately, over time, shift health outcomes for millions of people. So I really want to thank you for joining me here today and sharing about all of this. It's been incredible to hear about your journey, about your work, and I hope to hear more about all the exciting projects you have coming up in the near future.
Well, thank you so much, Maren. I really enjoyed this opportunity and just wanted to close by saying I'm always looking for new collaborators and new organizations. I mentioned the 100 networking meetings that I had when I was starting my business, and I love continuing to meet new people in this field. So I would say anyone who's interested in doing this work would love to explore opportunities for collaboration, and you can find me on LinkedIn or you can reach out by email at mmshealthstrategies@gmail.com. And thank you so much for the opportunity to chat with you today.
Absolutely. And we will put all of your links in the show notes below, so anyone who wants to reach out can find all your info there.
Thank you so much.
Thank you once again for listening to the Marian Flaxman Network podcast, a podcast dedicated to reintroducing personal narratives into critical public health topics. For more information on me, Marian, please visit my website at marianflaxman.com. For more information on my guest, Melissa Mayton Shepherd, please find the links in the show notes. This episode was produced by Brain Trust Productions and sponsored by Inform Solutions Consulting. As a reminder, this podcast reflects my own personal opinions and not the views of my employer, Cornell University. Thank you so much for listening, and we will see you next time.